Welcome today to the forum's first concurrent session. My name's Colin Yellowlees. I'm from RGA. I'm here to introduce the speakers and chair the session. On my immediate left here, I have Nicholas Warren. Nick is a consultant to Atfinity with a wide range of experience in analytics across the insurance industry. He has worked closely with large life and health insurers using analytics to profile and understand key drivers of customer behaviour. Nick is an expert in quantifying the impact of pricing, strategic and capital decisions. Nick is a qualified actuary and has a PhD in applied maths. He has spoken at industry and professional seminars, has written papers on a wide range of topics published in peer-reviewed journals. In the middle there is Stephen, who is a principal at Finity. He has applied machine learning techniques for life insurance clients, using these techniques to discover key drivers of risk for TPD and income protection claims. Stephen is a member of Finity's big data team, which has been developing unique insights into customer characteristics and their behaviours. So I'll hand it over to Nick and Stephen.
Good afternoon, everyone. So my name is Nicholas, and following me will be Stephen, and we're going to cover off some topics around data analytics for life insurers. Now, data analytics seems like a pretty hot topic at the moment, so hopefully we'll keep it nice and interesting for everyone. So I'll start off. I'll provide a bit of a background, sort of introduction, and then I'm going to head into some high-level considerations when embedding analytics within an organization. I'm then going to have a bit of a whirlwind tour of some modern analytics techniques. And at that point, I'm going to pass over to Stephen, who's going to bring it back to focus a little bit more on life insurance, and then a few case studies. So to orientate you a little bit, we're going to start off pretty high level, and then we're going to try and get more and more specific as we go through, and hopefully more and more practical as well. So let's set the scene. There's been a data explosion. Now, we all hear that phrase, sort of data explosion, data revolution, big data. They're sort of terms that are floating around the place at the moment. And you know, it's a little bit cliche, but it's probably worth dwelling on for just a second. So bear with me. If we think about things like Facebook, every minute of the day we're getting 4 million likes. That's a lot of thumbs up. If we're talking about Netflix, we're talking about 77,000 hours of video streamed every minute, or 51,000 downloads from Apple's App Store. That is a huge volume of data. Now, for me, while that's interesting, it's not really what captures my attention. What captures my attention is the fact that for any of this to happen, there's needed to be a revolution, not only data, but computing in general. Computing speed, the ability to store this data, and the ability to actually process it as well. So we're not just talking about a data revolution, we're talking about a technological revolution. Now, we're actuaries, or this is an actuarial meet. So what does it mean for insurers? Well, as insurers, we've been collecting data for a long time. We collect data when we underwrite a policy. We collect data on renewal. We collect data at claim time, obviously. So as insurers, we've been collecting data for a long time too. Now, we may not be able to compete directly with Facebook, but we're still dealing with a fairly significant volume of data. And most people don't quite know what to actually do with that data yet. Furthermore, if we're going to start talking about data, there's always the possibility of taking what data we have internally and expanding on it, augmenting it with external data sources. So augmenting it with census variables or with data partners like loyalty rewards programs or corporate partners. So there's always the ability to expand the data that we have. So it's not just data volume that we need to think about. It's about what can we learn from this data explosion? What can we learn from the Googles and the Microsofts and the Netflix, those sort of companies? What can we learn from them, and how can we apply that to insurance? What's relevant and what's not? So when I think about analytics, I like to think of it as happening in five key stages. So if we start down the bottom left, we're talking about an unaware sort of reactive view of the world, a very simple simple view of analytics. And as we move to the right, we're trying to extract more value from our data. As we move up, we're talking about more sophisticated analytics. So taking the bottom left, reporting. Now, reporting is the mainstay of life and of corporate life. And what I'm not saying here is that reporting is not adding value. What I'm talking about is how much value can we extract from the data. So reporting is essential. Let's not ignore that. But as we move along, the next step from reporting is descriptive analytics. Now, this is what most people think of when they think of analytics. But really, this is just business, you know, business analytics, cutting, slicing, dicing, using your well-known tools, your Tableau, your Cognos, those sort of business analyst tools. And this is moving from what's happened, the reporting sort of view of the world, to why did it happen? And that's a big sort of change in mindset about how we think about things. It's also where most companies are at. So most companies have a business analytics function set up. Now, moving to that next step, that predictive modeling step, that's a big jump. And it's a big jump for a few reasons. Firstly, we're no longer talking about the same skill sets. We're talking about a very different skill set and a very different set of people doing the work. We're moving from database administrators to people with statistical training. We're talking about a very different infrastructure as well. We're not just talking about a data warehouse. We're talking about specific software, specific modeling software that we can use that connects to our data warehouse. The next phase is prescriptive modeling. And for me, this is a bit of a blur between prescriptive and predictive, but it's really an indication of how mature an organization is in terms of the analytics. So it's about taking that predictive modeling and embedding it within the organization. How well is it used to set strategy? How well is it understood? What's the buy-in around the business? When we're launching a new product, do we do it and then do some ad hoc analytics, or does analytics inform what that product should look like? And then the final stage is proactive modeling. Now, this is where everyone's aiming to be, and I don't think really anyone knows what that is yet. It could be something like real-time blood sample genome analysis at underwriting. We don't really know what that is. We're getting there, but we can start to get some insights when we look at things like Uber, which has real-time demand pricing. So there's a few other key points that's worth sort of thinking about when you talk about this progression through different phases of analytics. And the first one is this is not a one-directional process. As you move along, every step you take, there's advantages for the previous steps. So, for example, when moving from a descriptive analytics view of the world to a predictive modeling view of the world, predictive modeling can certainly inform your understanding around why things have happened. You can actually interrogate the data and understand the true drivers of what's happened. It also can inform the lowest level. It can inform reporting. So if you think about some, say, lapse modeling, you've identified a key segment that you want to target with a really high lapse rate. That could then inform what you put in your reporting. I want to monitor this segment, and I want to understand how it's changing with these new initiatives we're putting in place. So this is not a one-directional flow at all. The last point I want to make is this is not a one-day journey either. You don't go from a back garage office with reporting in Excel spreadsheets to a proactive Netflix Uber model. This is a journey. And that journey is necessary because it requires time and it requires people to understand what's going on and to get buy-in at every stage. Now, as I mentioned, most companies sit in the descriptive and moving into the predictive modeling. So I don't really want to focus on descriptive analytics. I think we're all pretty familiar with that. I want to move into predictive modeling. And where would predictive modeling be in an analytics talk without some mention of machine learning? Machine learning is another one of these phrases that's thrown around the place, and it is a bit of a buzzword. And I guess there's good reason for that, because over the last 10 years, we've seen a dramatic increase in not only the number of algorithms and tools available, but also their ability to actually interrogate the data meaningfully. So if I was to stop there, it would sound like it's all roses. truth is that's not where it stops. Most of the algorithms that have been developed in a very domain-specific, for a very domain-specific purpose. So if I was to take something like deep learning, and for those of you who don't know what deep learning is, it's just a rebrand of neural networks. Deep learning has gained a lot of popularity at the moment with companies like Google and Microsoft because it is exceptionally good at image recognition and speech recognition. This is what sits behind the scenes picking out cats when you do your Google image search for cats. That's what sits behind the scenes. But it turns out if you try and use neural networks for things like insurance data, which have no spatial or temporal relationship between the input fields, they're not actually that good. So you need to know that. There's no silver bullet anymore. We've got a huge array of amazing methods, but if you don't know what you're doing, you'll actually produce a worse result than you could with a very simple analytical approach. The other thing is a lot of these methods need a certain amount of customization and a certain amount of understanding around basic diagnostics. No longer do they sit in the realm of just being academic toys anymore. They've definitely moved into the commercial space, but that also means that as practitioners, we need to understand how to use them, and we need to understand them at a level of enough detail that we know when to use them and when not to. It's like any analytics tool. Most importantly, as all analysts will know, understanding the data is imperative. That's a number one. But more than understanding just the data, what the fields are, what they mean, like the first thing you learn as an analyst, it's bigger than that now. It's about understanding the data pipeline, understanding where the data came from, the data governance processes that are in place, and how it went from the data warehouse into your model. And it sounds trivial, but it's not. In fact, it's that phase of the whole process that's really led to a complete paradigm shift in how most modeling is being undertaken. So traditionally, and what we see in most companies, is a very siloed approach, this current practice, where you have a separate data warehouse and we have a separate modeling platform. The actuary or the analyst will go to the data warehouse. Analyst asks for an extract. He'll put that through his model and do his analysis. It's very siloed and individual. More and more, we're seeing companies move to an integrated approach. And I've called that an integrated pipeline because it's not an integrated approach in the sense of the next phase, but it's two pieces of software that can communicate together and the data governance and processes around that are well established. But also moving to a data pipeline approach where we've got a well-defined data warehouse, it also means that we can have more frequent refreshes of the model and the underlying data. Moving forward one step again, we have where we're going, the future practice. And there we're talking about integrated cloud platforms. So if you look at where Microsoft and Google and IBM and Amazon are investing a lot of their money at the moment, it's these integrated cloud analytics platforms. So most of you will have heard of Netezza or Azure or AWS. These are the big cloud platforms that sit on server farms that allow you to put all your data in one place and run all your modeling in one place. It's a plug-and-play process. All the hard work, all the underlying computational complexity is done in the back end. The thing about this is because they're on server farms, they're also scalable. So it means you can have multiple users all using it at the same time. It also means you can refresh your data more frequently. So we're aware of at least one Australian supermarket chain that has reconciled sales reports updated every 15 minutes using this technology, nationally. Not locally, nationally. Oh. And that's me. So I'll pass across to Steve now.
All right. Is everyone here an actuary? I'm guessing everyone here's an actuary, so I'm going to talk as if everyone here's an actuary. No, someone's pointing someone out who's not an actuary. We have an intruder in the room. No? Okay, so there's one non-actuary in here. So we've spoken really broadly about analytics up until this point, and in other fields such as the marketing world, data analytics has really been quite transformational in how they do business. But what does it mean for a life insurer? Well, data analytics is actually not anything new for a life insurer. So except for the one exception, I think everyone in this room has been a data analyst at some point in their careers. And I would say that almost every single person in this room is still using data to make business decisions, you know, data-driven business decisions. So analytics has actually always been widespread across insurance. The only change in what we're proposing or what's happening in the world really is we're using better techniques and better tools. So in life insurance, we're seeing that insurers are using the tools that we talked about for risk segmentation, finding those target market segments and then keeping those high-value customers through retention modelling. So this is the same sort of thing that insurers have been doing for a number of years now. We're just doing it quicker and more efficiently. Over time, we're embedding those new practices into our business, into our normal business as usual processes. But it's also clear that we're just at the beginning of using the information that we collect as insurers and also external information. So that's probably been okay to date because insurers and financial institutions have always been very data-driven and there's a lot of value to be extracted in the data that we already have. However, that data explosion that we mentioned earlier on, that threatens one of the old insurance paradigms of risk pooling, because all of a sudden you can pull apart your risk a lot more and use that information for risk rating. So insurers that don't do that will eventually be selected against and fall behind. I mean, I know that sounds all pretty typical. You've heard it for 5 years. So where are the insurers doing that? And why haven't we seen all that massive change just yet? The answer to that is it's actually quite difficult. It's not straightforward. There's actually no single magical technique that you can just roll out and incorporate external data, and all of a sudden you're one of the new agile life insurer workshops. The costs up front are quite high. It's usually quite difficult to communicate the value of what you're trying to achieve. It doesn't help that there's a jargon barrier between IT people, actuaries, computing world, business people as well. And it's hard to know in advance what the benefits of big data solutions will be for our businesses until we really give it a go, try it, and refine it over time. But before we even get to that stage, we have to pay for the cost of getting the data, setting up the infrastructure, and, of course, the cost of our people as well. And on top of that, there's also compliance concerns regarding data security, privacy. Privacy legislation means that it might be a bit tricky to join two separate data sets to get those insights together. But finally, I think the biggest hurdle is actually in finding the right people. So we've spoken about the fact that we need people with computer coding skills, database admin, statistical modelling, communication, and business management. And they're hard people to find with all those skills. Actually, if there's anyone with all those expertises in the audience, can you please drop a CV off to Affinity Consulting? We're looking for them. But it's a unicorn. They don't really exist all in one spot. It's really a team-based approach. The last point I want to make on this slide is that while data analytics has been evolving in life insurance, the best way to actually start is to start small. Start with a small pragmatic solution that can be operationalized. It goes back to the earlier point that implementation happens in stages, and if we can start demonstrating value along the way, we can build support for analytics in the organization. So what about the next 10 years? Well, the opportunities are endless, if you ask me. If we think across the insurance value chain of customer acquisition, pricing, underwriting, retention, and claims management, I imagine that each of these core functions of an insurer will be touched by data analytics in one way or another over the next 10 years. The most obvious area will be in customer acquisition and pricing, I think. Insurers are already using health activity tracking through smartphones and Fitbits to find their customers. And over time, once that data builds up, you can see them using that for premium risk rating as well. We may also find that once we analyze that information, there's certain risk behaviors that drive certain claims behaviors. So you can use that information to re-engage with your customers and potentially change that behavior. Fitbits are a good example because they potentially change the relationship an insurer has with their customer from being just an insurer to possibly being an active health manager as well. Genome data is another thing we've heard quite a bit about. It's now more affordable to have your entire genome sequenced. So in 2001, it was $100 million per genome or something like that. You've probably heard this number before. And now it's about $1,000. So economically, it's quite foreseeable that this information would be used for life insurance underwriting in the near future. But I think there are probably some other questions that need to be answered before that becomes the case. On the marketing sales front, there's been a lot of talk, if you go to any kind of advertising conference, about marketing to one. So finding that one individual that you want to market to. So what this really means for insurers is developing ever more refined customer segments. And then that way we can find our marketing message, tailor it to that marketing to that person, and maximize the value of each touch point we have with our customer. Moving along the value chain to retention, this means understanding our target groups, what they need, what they want, who's most likely to lapse their policy, and then developing strategies to keep them. We could also look for the customers who are likely to be underinsured, those who are likely to have changed in their circumstances, contact those customers and offer them new products and services. Finally, on the claims front, so there's a lot of opportunity there, I think, to streamline claims management processes. One example might be to identify claimants who are more likely to engage a legal advisor based on how many phone calls they've made to your organisation and what they've said. So we can then use that information, then triage those claimants and engage with them in a different way. Another example I'll talk about a bit more later is using data analytics for fraud detection. We can actually use statistical techniques to find patterns and linkages which suggest abnormal behaviour very quickly. Sometimes not even just about predictive analytics, by the way. Just even summarising key information about your claims so that's available to the claims manager right up front on one screen can be quite valuable. Or maybe that report gets fed into a reporting system to the team manager. So once something starts going wrong, you can pick it up really quickly and make changes to the way you're managing those claims. Next, I want to talk about four analytics use cases that we've applied to life insurer or thereabouts cases. The first one is a single customer view. So we start with looking at a client's... So this is something we've done for a client. So in this example, we started looking at a client's own data and developing a single customer view. Pulling together a single customer view is quite important if we really want to harness all the information we have about our customers and to use that information to improve the way we deal with them. The more we understand about the customer, the more opportunities we have to design products and market to them specifically. However, in reality, most organizations are missing the core data foundation that will allow this to happen. Insurers do not have a unified data system that would allow analytics to be performed across their entire customer data universe. So working with a large life insurer, we can help them to combine and unify customer information spanning across 30 different systems. The database we created contained monthly snapshots of historical claim and policy information, similar to what actuaries are used to working with. We then attached to it internal customer contact information, such as satisfaction surveys, call center contacts, and other external data sources, such as census information. One point to note when doing that is it's most important to clean up the duplicates. Because there are a range of databases usually being used, there are quite a few, or often quite a few duplicates of your customer. Your customer might have two policy IDs, for example, in different databases, and it's not obvious from just looking at the data that way. So identifying those duplicated customers isn't a trivial task. So what we did in that case was perform a robust address cleansing procedure, mapped all the customers onto their home address, and just doing that paid significant dividends. And then you can combine that information with other unique customer IDs, such as date of birth, first name, last name, email address, telephone numbers, and then you can actually significantly pick out a lot of duplicate customer records. It's not uncommon for customers to have multiple policies, own multiple products across different brands, own a policy with multiple lives assured but not have cover themselves, or be identified on a life insurance policy not on their own. So a single customer view actually highlights how important it is when we want to determine optimal upsell targets. Without actually unifying all this customer data into the one spot, we don't know the person's true total cover, total benefits, number of benefits that they hold. The targeting customers based on individual policy details ignores all this. The final point I want to make on that is that developing a single customer view is actually quite difficult because of the number systems that you want to consolidate. But even if it doesn't make sense for organizations to jump straight in and do a big project to combine all the data sets, it's still a useful framework to start thinking about how you can transform your data or develop new data sets in the future. And meanwhile, at the same time, there are tools that have been developed to make it easier and quicker to join your data sets together. Next, I want to talk about bringing in some external information. So that was your own organization's information, pulling it all together. But let's bring in some external information here. So I'm going to go out on a limb here and say that life insurance products traditionally place a large emphasis on generic demographic information. So age, gender, occupation groups, marital status, sometimes medical history, and medical underwriting. But over the last few years, the importance of psychological factors in determining claims behaviours has been highlighted numerous times. We know that the behavioural traits and personalities will mean that some people are naturally more likely to return to work than others. So this is an area where bringing in external data sets to complement data collected by the insurer can be quite beneficial. So in a study that we did of TPD and income protection claims, we attach some very basic socioeconomic variables to the membership profile of a large group insurance program. Using a decision tree machine learning algorithm, we looked at the descriptive value of the data collected by the insurer and also the socioeconomic variables that we attached on. So we found that the socioeconomic variables were, after age, the biggest driver on whether policyholders made a claim or not. So it stands to reason that a person's home, family pressures, the enjoyment they get from work, the amount of income they're foregoing by not working, that type of stuff affects how long they stay off work for, whether they're likely to qualify for a TPD claim or not. So how can insurers use this information? Having a deeper understanding of the biopsychosocial factors, we can use that to help estimate risk relativities. For a group insurer, we could use this information to highlight differences between two populations that otherwise might look the same. On the claim side, we can look at those tendencies of claimants to certain biopsychosocial profiles and use that information as an input for claims triaging. We could also use this information a bit more strategically. So in this example, it's the Assure Health Insurance product, which was formed from a partnership between Qantas and NIB. In this example, Qantas investigated the uplift in the take-up of a product when analysing data using demographic and behavioural information, and they found that using demographic information alone, they can get a 2x uplift on just doing nothing. By identifying those target segment groups, but incorporating behavioural information, that goes up to around 3x. So you do want to bring in that external information to get that extra insight. Time. Busy slide. Love it. So this is this probably leads me to one of the main reasons why I think the explosion in big data is so exciting to insurers. It enables insurers to put all the information that we have about individuals or policyholders in one location, bring in large and diverse external data sets, and then use all this information to find your target customer. The idea is actually quite simple. Incorporate external information to do one of a few things. Enhance our understanding of our customers, which means we can refine our risk segmentation of them. Based on what we learn, look for opportunities to improve the products we provide and how we can reach them better. But perhaps the most intriguing possibility is bringing in external information to tell us information about those people who aren't your customers yet. We can look at external data sets, look for people in those external data sets that are likely to fit your target customer profile, and then leverage those data partnerships to reach out to new groups that you would otherwise would have to mass market to and hope they come to you. So in this busy slide, this is actually an example of something that Finity has been developing where we combine a range of separate data sets into a multi-dimensional view of every household in Australia. So we've consolidated key information of each household, such as who lives in it, their ages, their incomes, relationship to each other, their behaviours, all in one space, which means we can use this data set to quickly extract insights about the Australian population, current until 2015. So let me just play a hypothetical use case through. So imagine we're a life insurer. We want to launch a new product that appeals to families. This is an innovative product, so we want to appeal to early adopters of the product or people who are more likely to be early adopters. So how could we use, in this case, external data sets to actually help us find those customers? So what I've shown here is a map of Melbourne. Now, I don't know Melbourne very well, so please correct me if I get my spaces wrong. But the red areas highlight where there's a high proportion of households with children. Because households with children are more likely to need to insure their income and disability. And probably not surprising when this works. Not much in the CBD regions. They're mostly going to be your inner city renters, young renters. But the proportion of households with children goes up as we move into the suburbs. Excuse me. So this information is nothing new. It's what you can get from the ABS. But even just using the big data tools that we have now, this is done using Tableau, we can easily visualize this information. And if households with children is all we're interested in, we can start extracting insights about where the key pockets of households with children reside. But let us just refine that a little bit more and say, what about if we're interested in households with children who are also likely to have a mortgage? So now we're drilling down to households with both those characteristics. So this is a multi-way summary that's not available from public sources. So perhaps not surprisingly, the outer suburbs, they still dominate because they have the highest proportion of households that meet these criteria. But there are still some pockets in East Melbourne. Is that East Melbourne? Okay. And Caulfield, who have a fairly high share of households with mortgages. But what if we want to refine that further still? What if we want to combine this demographic information that we have about people and combine it with behavioural data? Well, if we refine our search a bit further and look for those customers who are likely to be early adopters and less budget conscious, we really get rid of a lot of the red and we're stuck with a lot of grey, but there's still pockets of red, out towards East Melbourne, Caulfield, and still solid pockets in the suburbs getting to the outer regions of Melbourne. So I don't know Melbourne stereotypes very well, but I understand like Caulfield's probably your richer families with a bit more income to lose, so they're there in red. And then these guys are in red because there are so many families out there. Now, if all we're interested in those three characteristics, here's your concentration of them. We know we can actually narrow down to where they are. We can refine further still. We can look at their We can incorporate your data, you know, insurer's own data and riskiness of each of those people, how much you charge for them, and then start building profitability maps as well, all in the one spot. We might look for whether there's shopping centres around anywhere there where you might want to put a bit of a store. Alternatively, I think the prospects of big data means we can bring information like social media habits, which TV shows they watch, when they're listening to the radio, and then use that information to then channel our marketing. So finally, I want to move away from customer information and move to claims. So data analytics, it's a bit blurry, deliberately so, by the way. So you're not, your eyes aren't going fuzzy. So data analytics can be quite useful for finding possible cases of fraud. So this is a motor accidents example. So it's a little bit different to life insurance, but some of these concepts could easily be applied to, say, a large group insurance scheme. So our client wanted to investigate the rapid increase in claims frequency in recent years and identify what common characteristics or common providers associated with those claims. What we did there was we used decision trees to narrow down the search for suspect providers by determining what type of claims had the biggest increase. And that wasn't easy because there's a lot of claims there, and those increases, they don't show in one way. It's not one type of claim. Once we identified the types of claims that had the largest increases, we did what we call network analysis to investigate whether there were any common providers who appeared to be a bit suspicious. So network analysis groups together service providers that work together. So, you know, one of these might be doctors, rehab advisors, lawyers, for example. So from doing this analysis, we found a number of common links between lawyers, rehab advisors, and doctors. Not surprisingly, it's showing there. So the power of data analytics here is that we were very quickly able to identify those likely candidates of fraud. The alternative to doing this would have been some poor law student sitting in their back room reading 1,000 files. Hopefully they pick up those links and hopefully they connect all those dots. It's pretty unlikely. Oh, we also then just mapped it onto, I guess you can see that's New South Wales and Sydney. So, I mean, there are a few use cases of where we've used data analytics, big data, external data sets internally. I'm sure there's a whole lot more, and other people are doing exciting things as well. But it is being done in life insurance, in other insurance. So just to conclude, I want to say that data analytics, it's about developing deeper understanding of your customers. So from this, we can then make better decisions across an insurer's whole operations. Using external data sets means we can supplement our own information with insights about policyholders' demographics, psychographic profiles, in more detail than we've ever been able to do before. And then we've got these machine learning techniques and awesome cloud computing, which means we have unprecedented capability to turn all that data into actionable insights. So just some final thoughts for those embarking down this journey. Disruption, it's usually incremental. The big disruptors you hear about, Airbnb, Uber, they're the exception rather than the rule. So from that point of view, always look for ways you can incrementally improve the way you do things. Secondly, insights are the valuable thing that we're trying to extract, and analytics is just a tool. So sometimes even just really basic data analytics can lead to tremendously valuable insights. Nick mentioned this earlier. No one really knows where this is all going. The future of data analytics is evolving. So 10 years ago, there was no such thing as Netflix or a smartphone. But what this means is we need to be adaptable and agile. And finally, it's helpful to start by defining your business goals, and maybe that's just make money. But what is it that you're trying to achieve? And analytics are just a tool to get there. Cool. Thank you.
Okay, so now we'll take questions. So anybody with a question, please come up to the microphone, speak clearly into it, and state your name.
You must be very precise.
Daniel Stone from Tell Life. You talked a bit about a database that you've built together, brought together quite a few data sources. You spoke earlier about early adopters. You could identify people that were going to be early adopters and a couple of those factors. Kind of, can you explain what kind of sources and how it all fits together a little bit?
So, Denny, are you interested in sort of the type of information that we've incorporated into this data set?
Yeah, how you kind of put it together to make it so they're not the have unique fields that you can match.
Yep. So, one yep. So, there was a lot of hard work, I guess. So we sort of put a lot of different data sources together through, I guess, a lot of statistical modeling to try and model the relationship between different factors. So, for example, if you think about behavioral aspects like their likelihood to be a sort of shopper versus someone who sort of just, you know, stick around if they have insurance. And if you talk about, early adopters of technology. So we sort of have access to a lot of market survey data. And based on those data, we built statistical models to correlate demographic and geographic factors that correlates with those type of behavior. And those get scored back to, the census demographic data in order for us to incorporate all these different dimensions to this single data set.
Sorry, just also to add to that, the core is actually from a lot of ABS information, and what we've done is back engineer the census and then make it current to 2015. So we have a record for every person and every household. I mean, that's John was touching on the statistical modeling that we use to do that. Now we did that just for fun, I guess. And the whole point is, I think, using these new techniques, we wouldn't have been able to do this a couple of years ago. We pulled it all together, fairly efficiently, I guess. And we think it's got valuable insight. And that's one of the exciting things about big data, is that you can pull together interesting data sets like this, which then, doesn't sound very sexy. It's just census information. But, there's a lot of valuable insight that can be extracted from it.
Carolina Stevenson from Quantium here. Just wondering, you've talked a lot about sort of various lifetime view, single customer view and big data sets and those sorts of things that you've pulled together. Just wondering whether you can share any examples where you've, in conjunction with clients, implemented something off the back of that and what that, obviously bearing in mind sensitivities, but what kind of things you've done with it that have led to some different outcomes.
Hi, Carolina. There, I can't go into details around too many things, obviously, but there are a number of initiatives that have come off the back of the single customer view that we've built. Two that spring to mind are a data-driven segmentation of the entire customer base. So the insurer that we worked with has product holdings across multiple insurance industries. And so segmenting those across a across different industries and the customers and how they fall across those industries is quite interesting, because it then plays into the hands of marketing and how you actually go about your marketing. And the second one is to do with, I guess, more profit-driven, retention-based modeling, and using the fact that you now have a dedupe system to understand the true drivers or the actual drivers of customer behavior. Because it's very easy to start modeling lapse and completely ignore the fact that the customer is still with you at the company. They've just lapsed a single policy, and it's because that policy was sitting on a different system. So your relationship with the customer is still there. So that's been quite insightful, and it's led to, if not distinct actions, it's led to quite a lot of education around the company that we've worked with.
Since there's no questions, I guess I'll also add that we at Affinity, we also do general insurance consulting, not just life insurance. So that's helpful information for home insurers, home and contents, motor insurers, for example. So we work with them as well.
If you go back about, say, 10, 20 years ago, there was a lot of work done on, say, expert systems and those sorts of things. And we seem to have moved much more to a data-driven analytics. How are we actually blending, I guess, what we're trying to achieve out of expert systems with taking people's individual expertise in claims management, for example, and blending that with, I guess, the data-driven approach?
I don't think data-driven decision-making removes experts. So I'm not sure I understand the question properly, because what expert thing is, but I'm assuming it's finding experts in those areas and using them. It doesn't replace it. I think what we're trying to say is judgment has its limitations, or severe limitations if you go by any of the research. So what we're saying is just supplement the judgment with some data, with some analytics, have the information right in front of you before you make those decisions.
Yeah, well, from my experience, sort of working with the claims department of different insurers, one thing with the sort of expert knowledge is that you can actually incorporate that into your data system. So you use your data to confirm or learn from the data pattern that can support some of these expert knowledge. The other thing that we also notice is the environment around some claims behavior can change quite quickly, and with a lot of these data-driven systems, they tend to be able to pick up these changes more quickly because it takes the experts a little bit of time to actually learn what's going on.
That's time, so thanks very much to Stephen, Nick and John. If you could all give them a round of applause.